I've gotten to teach, and we're in the home stretch, I guess you could say, of our study together. We're in the final 2 weeks. If you would turn to 2 Samuel, we'll begin in chapter 13 in just a moment. And this morning, our goal is to look at chapters 13, 14, and 15. By way of review, I'm not going to go all the way back to the beginning of 2 Samuel, but just going back to chapter 8. In chapter 8, we read of David triumphing over his enemies, finding great success. And the success that David felt and enjoyed was through the Lord. Chapter 8, verse 14 tells us that the Lord helped David wherever he went. David had been spared repeatedly from his enemies. You can think all the way back to him taking on the lion or him going against a great giant Goliath and how he was victorious. You think about all the times that his life was spared as King Saul was trying to kill him. You think about all the enemies that he faced, whether it was the Philistines or if it was the Moabites. David was victorious over and over again through the Lord. And so David's success and deliverance was brought about because he was faithful to the Lord, and the Lord blessed him abundantly. David was reigning over Israel, all of Israel during this time, and we know that David was very faithful to his promises, and we saw an example of that in chapter 9 of 2 Samuel. He made oaths repeatedly with Jonathan, his dear friend, and in chapter 9 he had the opportunity to reach out to Jonathan's son, Mephibosheth, who was lame in his feet. And how he blessed him and told him he could dine with him and blessed him abundantly. And so he was loyal and faithful to his promises. We also have read of in chapter 10, David being incredibly successful in his military pursuits. Even in chapter 10, they are going from place to place and they are battling against enemies of the Lord and against the Ammonites and the Arameans. And David is successful. However, when you get to chapter 12, and Larry covered this on Wednesday night, the sin with Bathsheba, and how at this moment things do take a drastic turn. And we see this individual committing this great sin. At a time when he should have been out on the battlefield, he was at home. At a time when he saw Bathsheba bathing, he could have gone inside. And he continued to look at her and gaze upon her and lust after her. And then when he asked about who is this woman, and he was told that this is the wife of Uriah the Hittite, he could have left it there. And he didn't. Again, he would not put any of those boundaries there that he needed to put in place so that he would not sin further. And so he brought Bathsheba to himself. They committed adultery. And from there, it didn't stop. Because she was with child, he felt like he had to cover his sin. And so he had Uriah brought back from the battle lines. And on two occasions, he tried to get Uriah to go home and be with his wife to cover his own sin. And Uriah, being a very commendable, respectful man, would not do it because there were other men that were out on the battlefield and he would not do such a thing. And so what did David do? He had him killed. And it's amazing to think about, we talked about that Wednesday night, that he sent Uriah with his own death warrant in his own hand to Joab. And then he perished. And then how did David even react to that sin? He didn't react to someone who had really grasped the consequences of what he had done. When he found out about Uriah's death, he much more seemed to have a sigh of relief that this thing had been covered to some degree, he felt like. It isn't until chapter 12, which we studied at the end of class on Wednesday night, that the Lord, through Nathan, went to David. And it is important that it's Nathan the prophet that speaks to him, but who sent Nathan the prophet? The Lord. And in that those statements that are made, the Lord speaks through Nathan the prophet by beginning with the story of a poor man and a rich man. The poor man who had one lamb that meant everything to him. He treated it as a daughter. But then the rich man had lambs in abundance. He had flocks and herds everywhere. And this rich man took this poor man's one lamb and killed it. It made David angry. David didn't realize the whole story was about him. And then Nathan made the statement, "You are the man." Did David realize his sin? He did. He realized he had sinned. Was he forgiven of his sin? Were there consequences to his sin? And I think that's the key. As we go through these next several chapters, we have to remember the consequences of the sin that are mentioned here. If you look here, the consequences that are mentioned in 1 Samuel chapter 12 that Nathan the prophet said to him, which came from the Lord. In verse 10, he said, "The Lord shall never depart from your house because you despise me." In verse 11, "I will raise up evil against you from your own household. I will even take your wives before your eyes and give them to your companion, and he will lie with your wives in broad daylight." And in verse 14, "The child also that is born to you shall surely die." These are the consequences of David's sins. The word of the Lord came through Nathan the prophet to David. And this one that we read of here in verse 14, that the child that is born to you shall surely die, that happened. The child that was to be born to David and Bathsheba perished. And we're also told in verse 24 of chapter 12 that David and Bathsheba did have another son named Solomon, and that the Lord loved Solomon. But we do know of these consequences. So as we go through these next few chapters, chapters 13 through 15, it's very important that I think we have these consequences in mind, that David was going to have consequences of his sin. Although he had been forgiven, things start to unravel as you read these next several chapters and the rising of Absalom into the kingdom. Sin is damaging. When you look here at this chart, at the end of Wednesday night's class, I heard someone behind me saying, Grant, whispering to me. And it was Rose. And Rose had her study Bible in her hand, and she passed it up to me and said, "Look at this." And so I took a picture of it. And so this is a really nice chart that's from her study Bible, and you see this turn. On the left side, your left side, David's rise. You see how up to this point, much of what we read of David has been so commendable. You have this warrior for God. You have this individual who's so brave and decisive. You have this person who petitions God constantly. His prayers are effective. He seems to be fearless. But then you have the sin with Bathsheba, and you see a man in these next few chapters who is different in some ways, who begins to struggle. We do see in some of these chapters that we read, he's indecisive at times. The way he deals with Absalom shows some moments where he's not sure what to do. And he's going to be taking a census at the end of 2 Samuel. Read of that and how that made the Lord very angry and how he did that. And so you do see an individual that after the sin with Bathsheba, he begins to make some decisions that are not the same type of decisions I think he would have made earlier on before the sin with Bathsheba. And his killing of Uriah the Hittite. So there's definitely some situations here to consider. As we look here at chapter 13, if you'll look in your Bibles with me, here at the very beginning of chapter 13, we read of three very important characters here. One character that we read of is Amnon. And this individual is mentioned at the end of verse 1. When you read here, "Now it was after this that Absalom, the son of David, had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar, and Amnon, the son of David, loved her." Well, who was Amnon? Amnon was the firstborn son of David. We can read of that in chapter 3, verse 2. He was born to him by Ahinoam of Jezreel while he was at Hebron, before he even had ever come to Israel. So Amnon, by order of birth, with him being the firstborn son, would technically have been the heir apparent to the throne of David at this time. Absalom is also mentioned here, and Absalom was a son of Maacah. And we read that also in chapter 3. And Maacah had Absalom and also had Tamar. And so they were brother and sister, Absalom and Tamar were. We know that both Tamar and Absalom were both attractive. Here, Tamar is described as being beautiful. As we read here in verse 1, we know Absalom, later on in chapter 14, verse 25, it speaks of Absalom being very handsome, that he was more handsome than all of the men of Israel. And so these were beautiful individuals. Well, Amnon was in love with Tamar, his half-sister. And as you read this account, we do realize that there was love, I guess you could say, but more so, what was it? It was intense lust. Amnon's lust for Tamar was so strong that he would make himself physically ill. And we do see that that's going to play a part in this acting job that he's going to come up with. Actually, his friend's going to come up with here. But Tamar was a virgin daughter of the king, and Amnon was frustrated because he wanted to be with her. And he felt there was no opportunity for him to have opportunity to be with her. And so Abnon had a friend. I guess you could call him a friend. Not really, but that's what he was. But he was his cousin, and his name was Jonadab. And Jonadab came up with this scheme, because Jonadab is recorded as being very shrewd, if you look at verse 3. But Abnon had a friend whose name was Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother, and Jonadab was a very shrewd man. Some translations say that he was cunning or crafty. But he came up with this scheme for Abnon to feign being ill, to act like he was sick. And then what would happen is if he acted sick, the king would come to him, David would come to him, and he would ask him what he wanted. And what he would request would be for Tamar to come to him and to fix food for him. That would be his request. So Jonadab had this idea, this is a way that you can get Tamar to you and to have an opportunity with her. So Amnon liked this idea, he liked Jonadab's deceitful and wicked scheme. And so Amnon feigned illness, and he requested for Tamar to come to him, that he may eat from his sister's hand. As we continue on, Amnon's acting skills must have been convincing, because King David came to him when he acted like he was sick. And then when he made this request for Tamar to come to him, David gave to the request and said, Tamar needs to come and bring food or prepare food for him. So Tamar obeyed the voice of her father David. She came to Amnon and she prepared cakes. Would Amnon eat the cakes? No. So he wouldn't eat. And then he told everyone to get out of his presence and for Tamar to stay and to bring the food to his bedroom. So Tamar obeyed and she brought the food to him. And Amnon, at that point, took hold of her. In verses 11 through 14, we read of this account here, and I'll read verses 11 through 14. Beginning in verse 11, when she brought them to him to eat, he took hold of her and said to her, come lie with me, my sister. But she answered him, no, my brother, do not violate me, for such a thing is not done in Israel. Do not do this disgraceful thing. As for me, where could I get rid of my reproach? And as for you, you will be like one of the fools in Israel. Now, therefore, please speak to the king, for he will not withhold me from you. However, he would not listen to her. Since he was stronger than she, he violated her and lay with her. So Amnon, at this moment of lust, he had no regard whatsoever for the sound and righteous judgments of Tamar. Tamar said exactly what needed to be said and acted so righteously in this moment. She said, such a thing is not done in Israel. She told him plainly, do not do this disgraceful thing. She was not willing to consensually lie with him because she was going to act in righteousness. And she said, where could I get rid of my reproach? Tamar was a virgin daughter of the king. How devastating this would be to her position in the king's house. She would lose her honor. She would lose dignity. Tamar even, I think this is amazing on her part, that she even thinks about the impact on what it would be like for Amnon to commit this act. She even makes the point to Amnon that you're going to be like a fool in Israel if you do this. He would have no respect. He would have no honor. She even said to Amnon that he could even speak to the king. And if he spoke to the king, that David would not withhold Tamar from Amnon. But Amnon would not listen. He wouldn't listen. Reminds us again of what we said just a few minutes ago. If you remember David, would David listen in the moment with Bathsheba? Would he listen to that's Uriah, the Hittite's wife? No. His mind was made up. And so Amnon refused to listen to reasoning, and he committed this wicked sin against his half-sister Tamar. The College Press commentary makes an interesting point here, and says, we are left to wonder if Amnon would have been bold enough to commit this crime if David had lived a holier life. Now, that's a pretty bold statement to say, because we know that David was a man after God's own heart. But if you think about it, this is 2 Samuel chapter 13. We're following up the sin against Bathsheba and what he did with Uriah the Hittite. And we know that so often men make decisions and to commit wickedness sometimes because they see it in their father. Their father's terrible, wicked example sometimes plays a part in them falling into similar traps. And so his influence here definitely, I think, played a part in Amnon committing wickedness here. And obviously Amnon's own sin was his own. But there was an influence here that David's sin was known. And the influence that it had on his children is interesting. Also, we have to think about what we said a few minutes ago. Was there consequences for David's sin? This is where the unraveling begins. Because from this act, this sets off Absalom, which then causes Absalom to commit murder, which then causes Absalom to cause an uprising, which then causes the kingdom to come from David's hand to Absalom. And you see this thing just begin to unravel. Andy? That's right.
But he had that example for his son and sons, and other things, other fallout from sin. And so sin many times has a permanent legacy, even if we repent and devoid ourselves of it. The consequences, as you said, are many times still there.
That's right. That's right. I think that's why it's really important to read these chapters in the connection of the consequence of sin of chapter 12, of what the Lord said through Nathan. So this terrible action was committed by Amnon. It would devastate David. It would devastate their family and their whole household. And this sin would set into action this sword that was spoken of that would wreak havoc and devastation upon David's house. Here in verses 15 through 23, we read of the effects of sin. These same effects are oftentimes apparent after sinful deeds are even committed today. The one who commits sin sometimes reacts with guilt. They react sometimes with resentment. The victim sometimes reacts with humiliation or with shame. Oftentimes the parties who know of the sin, maybe family members or friends, when they hear of the sin, they react with embarrassment or maybe anger upon hearing of the sin. And we see that all played out here. How did Amnon react after he had committed this terrible sin? He hated her. This woman that supposedly he loved so much that he was making himself physically ill now hated her with a greater hatred than he ever loved her. So Amnon told her to go away, to get out. Quite a turn, right? Tamar told Amnon that sending her away would be an even greater wrong than the act that he committed. Tamar was utterly humiliated and ashamed. Amnon would not listen to her. He even had a young man come and take her and throw her out and lock the door behind her. Tamar was wearing a long sleeve robe that was given to the virgin daughters of the king. You can imagine this robe was probably beautiful. What does Tamar do with this robe? She tears it. She was ashamed. So she takes this precious garment that represented her position, and she ripped her beautiful robe just as her innocence had been torn from her. She put ashes on her head. She began to mourn and cry, and she put her hand on her head and wept aloud as she left. What was Tamar's brother's, Absalom, reaction to all this? Now, if you look at verse 20, we read of his reaction. When Absalom, her brother, said to her, "Has Amnon, your brother, been with you? But now keep silent, my sister. He is your brother. Do not take this matter to heart." Initially, when you read verse 20, you may think that Absalom is rather uncaring or unfeeling upon hearing about this. But how did Absalom actually feel? Furious. And you see that in verse 22. If you skip down to verse 22, "But Absalom did not speak to Amnon either good or bad, for Absalom hated Amnon because he had violated his sister Tamar." What was Absalom really trying? What was he really plotting out? "I'm going to kill him." Now, he doesn't do it instantly. It's going to take 2 years for it to happen. But he's going to get rid of Amnon. He's going to kill him for what he had done to Tamar. How did David react? So David's reaction we read of here in verse 21. Now when David heard of all these matters, he was very angry. So he was mad too. Did David do anything? No. Now, there might be lots of reasons why you might say he didn't do anything here. But you could say in some ways maybe that his own guilt from his own wickedness, of him committing the sin with Bathsheba, him having Uriah the Hittite killed, maybe felt like it tied his hands and hindered him from carrying out righteous judgment against Adonai. So after 2 years, Absalom created an opportunity to kill Adonai. Absalom had sheep shears in Baal-Hazor, and so he invited the king's sons to come. We read of this in verse 23. So Baal-Hazor was about 20 miles north of Jerusalem. So here's a map we can see. I know this is rather small, but you can see Jerusalem there in the center of our map. About 18 to 20 miles north was Baal-Hazor. And this would be the place where Absalom would plot to kill his brother, Amnon. So as we continue on, here's where the plot is carried out. Absalom invited the king and the king's sons to go with him. What this was, a time of sheep shearing, was a time of feasting. Oftentimes they had a great feast that would partner up with this time of year. So David initially told Absalom that he would not go because he would be a burden to him. And so Absalom again urged David to go and for the sons to go, and David said he would not go, but he blessed them. Well, Absalom was very persistent, so he said, I want Amnon to go with me. And David initially thought that sounded very odd, that he was asking specifically for Amnon to go on this trip. But eventually what happened was is that David did give in, and Amnon and the sons of David were sent to go up to Baal-Hazor for this sheep shearing, for this feast. So Absalom commanded his servants to kill Amnon after his heart was merry with wine. If you look at verse 28, Absalom commanded his servants, saying, "See now, when Amnon's heart is merry with wine, and when I say to you, strike Amnon, then put him to death. Do not fear. Have not I commanded you? Be courageous and valiant. Be valiant." The servants of Absalom did to Amnon just as Absalom had commanded. Then all the king's sons arose, and each mounted his mule and fled. So the servants carried out this act and carried out Absalom's command to kill Amnon. And after he had killed him, all the king's sons got on their mule and they fled back to Jerusalem. Initially, this news starts to get back to David. And the report that comes back to David at the very beginning is not that Amnon is dead, but that who is dead? All the sons are dead. And so when David hears this initial report and he hears that all of his sons have been killed by Absalom, he hears this, he tears his clothes, he lays on the ground. And then in verse 32, Jonadab, by the way, who's Jonadab? The same guy who came up with the cunning, deceitful scheme for all this to happen in the first place with Amnon and Tamar, same guy, says, wait, all the king's sons aren't dead, just Amnon. All the king's sons aren't dead, just Amnon. And so he told him in verse 32 that this was the intent of Absalom since the day that he, Amnon, violated his sister Tamar. Ever since that day when it happened, Absalom had been planning and plotting this to happen, that he was going to kill Amnon. So for 2 years, he had been planning this out. So rather than losing all of his sons, he had lost his firstborn son, who was killed by Absalom's servants. The watchmen looked out. They saw the sons of David coming back and returning into the city. And when they all returned, the king and all of his sons wept bitterly for what had happened. After Amnon had been killed, Absalom fled. He left and went to Talmai, the son of Ammitud, the king of Geshur. Now, what's interesting about this is, does Absalom just go to some random place? This is not a random place. If you look at 2 Samuel chapter 3, verse 3, it tells us that Absalom was the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. So he actually was fleeing to his maternal grandfather. That's where he went. And so Absalom stayed there with his grandfather, with his family on his mother's side, for 3 years. During those 3 years, how did David feel? He missed Absalom terribly. And we read of that, that in verse 39, well, let's look a little bit higher, in 37. Now Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Ammitud, the king of Geshur, and David mourned for his son every day. So Absalom had fled and gone to Geshur and was there 3 years. The heart of King David longed to go out to Absalom, for he was comforted concerning Amnon since he was dead. So we see here that he longed for Absalom, but for 3 years he was separated from him. So in this chapter we see that David is becoming more and more indecisive, that for 3 years he grieves for Absalom, but he doesn't do anything to solve the problem. He lacked action after Tamar was violated by his oldest son. He started to display a bit of a passive attitude instead of reaching out to Absalom in some way, shape, or form. All right. Do we have any comments or questions before we continue on? Okay, here is a map, and you can see where Geshur was, where Absalom would have fled to. So this is quite the distance of him moving northeast, away from Jerusalem, to go up to his maternal grandfather. We also do need to point out Tekoa, this place that's about 20 miles, 18 to 20 miles south of Jerusalem, which is going to be where Joab would find, in chapter 14, a very wise woman to bring some things to mind concerning David. So let's begin chapter 14. In chapter 14, as we just read, David was longing for Absalom. His heart was inclined to him. And so Joab saw how he longed deeply for his son. And so Joab came up with a plan to solve this problem. And so what he did was that he sent to Tekoa, and he found a wise woman who was there. She was brought back. And in verses 2 and 3, it is recorded that Joab told her to be pretty much an actress. He told her to pretend that she was in mourning, to put on mourning garments, not to anoint herself with oil, to act like she had been crying and weeping and mourning for days, and also that he would say the words he gave her. So he's going to give her lines to say, I guess to recite, before the king. Now, the whole plan here is that she's going to go before the king and make some statements and tell a fictional story to David so that David will realize this situation with Absalom can be resolved in some way. And so Joab desired for this woman to go to David and to seek his help. She would tell a story that would cause him to think about a situation. So she told the king, if you look here at verses 4 through 7, the story was that when she gets to the king, she said that she was a widow and that she had two sons. These two sons were in the field together, and they fought. And one of the sons killed the other. So when this happened, in verse 7, after the death of her son, her whole family rose together and said, "Hand over the one who struck his brother, that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed, and destroy the heir also." So these two brothers fought, one kills the other, and all the family saying, the one who is the murderer, the one who killed the other, needs to pay for the price of the crime. So she said that if that was to happen, it would extinguish her only coal that was left. All she had left was his son. And it would leave her husband's name with no remnant. As she spoke the story to David, David's listening to the story. And then he doesn't realize yet that this is a parallel to his own story. He doesn't realize yet that this is really supposed to parallel his situation with Absalom and Amnon. So as she continues here, David hears the woman's fictional story and he agrees with her that this son that's living should not be put to death. And he says in verse 10, "Whoever speaks to you, bring him to me, and he will not touch you anymore." In verse 11, David makes judgment and says, "As the Lord lives, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground." And in verse 13, the woman then continued by saying, "Why then have you planned such a thing against the people of God? For in speaking this word, the king is as one who is guilty, in that the king does not bring back his banished one. For we surely die and are like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. Yet God does not take away life, but plans ways so that the banished one will not be cast out from him. This is where the woman from Tekoa hits the nail on the head. And she's making the point that Absalom needs to be brought back, practically is what she is implying. If you make this judgment for me, why wouldn't you bring back your own son, your own banished one? So, at this point, she speaks respectfully to David. She says, "Please let the word of my lord the king be comforting, for as an angel of God, so is my lord the king, to discern good and evil. And may the Lord your God be with you," in verse 17. So the woman's statements at this point, when she starts to speak of your own banished one to make some of these statements, a light bulb's going off in David's head. This woman maybe has revealed that she knows too much information, or things just aren't adding up here. And so David makes a statement to here in verse 18, and he says to her, "Please do not hide anything from me that I am about to ask you." And the woman said, "Let my lord the king please speak." So the king said, "Is the hand of Joab with you in all this?" David is very wise. And he hears this story, and this woman's a good actress. But she's not that good, I guess you could say. And David figures it out. And so the woman is honest. She speaks back and replies and says, "Indeed, it was your servant, Joab, who commanded me. And it was he who put all these words in the mouth of your maidservant in order to change the appearance of things. Your servant Joab has done this thing." Is this the first time that someone has come to David and spoken to him and has changed the story or the appearance of things so that he'll understand his own story? When has it happened before? Nathan. Yeah, Nathan didn't start off and the first sentence was, "You are the man." He started with this story. And I know this is a little bit different, but think about, how did Jesus teach? He used parables. So often used parables that would teach us these truths, using physical things we understand so that we can understand spiritual things. And you see that here, that using this path, using this way of storytelling, David could understand his own situation with his own son in such a deeper way. And so the words of this woman were effective. If you look at verse 21, "The king said to Joab, 'Behold now, I will surely do this thing. Go therefore and bring back the young man Absalom.'" I'm going to do it. Go get Absalom. He's been gone. Let's bring him back. How did Joab react to this? Great rejoicing. It worked. That's right. He's glad that he listened to him. And so Joab falls with his face to the ground. He said, "Today your servant knows that I have found favor in your sight, O my lord the king, in that the king has performed the request of his servant." So Joab went to Geshur. He brought back Absalom to Jerusalem. And in verse 24 we read, "However, the king said, 'Let him turn to his own house, and let him not see my face.' So Absalom turned to his own house, and he did not see David's face." In verses 25 through 27, it tells us more specifics, kind of a side note, about Absalom's physical appearance and his offspring. We read here that Absalom was handsome in appearance. We mentioned that earlier, that his sister Tamar was also beautiful and attractive. It says here that no one was as handsome as Absalom, so highly praised. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no defect in him. It also speaks of Absalom's hair. And why do you think it talks about Absalom's hair? This is going to be part of his downfall, I guess you could say. And so part of his demise. His hair weighed 200 shekels by the king's weight. Some have said that his hair would have weighed somewhere around 5 to 6 pounds. And so each year his hair would have to be cut because it was very heavy on him. And so Absalom also, it says here, he had 3 sons and he had 1 daughter. What was the name of his 1 daughter? Tamar. He named his daughter after his sister. And just like Tamar, his sister, his daughter, was also very beautiful in appearance. So after he returned with Joab, Absalom was in Jerusalem for 2 years. So Absalom was so convicted in his heart, "Let's go get Absalom, let's bring him back. Go send him to his own house." He doesn't see him for 2 years. 2 years he's there. How does Absalom feel during this time? "Why am I here? Why am I here? He brought me back. He won't even bring me in. I can't even go before the king. It'd be better for me to be back in Geshur." And so he gets very frustrated. He calls two times for Joab and says, call for the king. I want Joab to come to me so he will call to the king so I can go see him. Joab won't come. So Absalom is fed up. What does he do? He tells his servants to go set Joab's field on fire. That'll get his attention. And it does. So Joab, in verse 31, Joab arose and came to Absalom at his house and said to him, why have your servants set my field on fire? And Absalom told him and answered Joab, behold, I sent for you saying, come here, that I may send you to the king to say, why have I come from Geshur? It would be better for me to still be there. So he desired so badly to see the king, and he would do pretty much anything he had to do to get the attention of Joab so it would happen. So we do find in verse 33, Joab finally brings Absalom to the king. But I did skip something we need to see. The sentence right before that. Absalom said to Joab, now therefore, let me see the king's face. If there is iniquity in me, let him put me to death. He was willing to go to the king and go speak to his father, come what may. Even if David said there's iniquity in Absalom and he needs to pay the price for Abnon, for what he had done to Abnon and killing him, so be it. Let me just go, rather than be in this situation where I'm here. And so Joab finally took him to David. He called for Absalom, and finally they see each other. When they see each other, he comes before the king. He bows before him with his face to the ground, and David kisses his son. So we see that throughout this section, David was struggling with being indecisive. His heart longed for Absalom, yet he was reluctant to bring him back. And even when he brought him back, he didn't bring him back in his presence. And so through the woman of Tekoa, he learned a lesson here. But for much of this time, for 2 years, he did not see, obviously did not see Absalom until this moment. As we continue here, in chapter 15, we read of Absalom's rise. And as we read of Absalom's rise to power, it's very important for us to see that Absalom's rise to power is not a situation where someone anoints Absalom. It's not a situation where he comes to power in that way. How does Absalom rise to power? He makes himself rise to power. And again, that's very interesting, but remember, there's consequences to David's sin. 2 Samuel chapter 12. And some of those things that are mentioned specifically as far as what would happen to David and to his kingdom, they happen through Absalom. Absalom is the avenue in which those things come to play, those consequences. And so we read here of, I think in these upcoming chapters, the sword will never depart from your house. We see that sword in action through Absalom. We see evil raised up against David from his own household. That happens through Absalom. Another consequence of his sin is that I will even take your wives from before your eyes and give them to your companions, and you will lie with your wives in broad daylight. Absalom does that. So Absalom is where we see the consequence of David's sin manifested. In verse 1, Absalom provides for himself a chariot. He has horses, he has 50 men, and he goes early in the morning to the gate. And when any man would come to the king to settle a dispute, Absalom would call to them, and he would act as judge. Now it sounds here like Absalom was jumping the line, so to speak. He was usurping the authority of the king, because he was superseding the king, saying in verse 4, oh, that one would appoint me judge in the land. Then every man who has any suit or cause would come to me, and I would give him justice. The people would come before Absalom. They would bow before him, and Absalom would take their hand and he would kiss them. We see Absalom turning the people of Israel to him, where they appreciate him and they value his judgment. It says in verse 6, a very important statement, in this manner, Absalom dealt with all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole away the hearts of the men of Israel. People were so amazed by the wisdom and the power and the judgment of David. And now Absalom, his son, was stealing away the hearts of Israel to himself. They were charmed by Absalom's handsomeness. They were charmed by his charisma. We will pause right here this morning, and we will begin here in verse 7 on Wednesday night. If you would, please read chapter 16, 17, and 18 for Wednesday night. That would be great. Thank you all.